This is an ABC podcast.
Hello and a big welcome to The Art Show here on RN. My name's Ed Ayres, and to be honest, I am bursting with excitement because today you are going to hear from one of the world's most famous artists, a man who has gone around the world with a lot of material and brought a strange beauty to whatever he covers with it. He is a Midas with cloth, and his name is Christo. It's 50 years since he wrapped Little Bay in Sydney and kicked off the Caldor Public Art Projects. On the show today, I'll also be speaking with John Caldor and friends about those projects. Now, if you can lift yourself off the floor with the shock of hearing about Christo, maybe if you could take a moment in the next few minutes also to search for the images of Mona Chalabi, that's C-H, Chalabi, and especially on her Instagram page. Mona's a data journalist and artist. She's coming on the show in about half an hour, but if you can check out her work beforehand, it will be worth it. Or afterwards, because right now we have Christo. Christo!
Christo arrived in Sydney with his 9-year-old son and Parisian wife, Jeanne Claude. Many are mystified by the packaging at Little Bay.
In October 1969, two contemporary artists arrived in Sydney with a strange and particular vision. They wanted to wrap the coastline in enormous lengths of white fabric. The artists were Christo and his wife, Jean-Claude. Now, it's an astonishing feat now, but think about its impact back then in 1960s Australia. It was certainly an act that transformed the cultural landscape in more ways than one. Well, this year marks 50 years since the beginning of the John Caldor Public Art Projects, which were themselves kickstarted by Christo's Wrapped Coast at Little Bay in Sydney. And Christo joins me on the phone line from New York. Christo, welcome to The Art Show.
Good morning. It's Australia, no?
Yes, absolutely. It's good morning. Christo, thank you so much for doing this quick interview. Christo, you were 34 years old when you and Jean-Claude created Wrapped Coast. So what was the original impetus for your vision?
For long years, we were planning to do something in the coastal line. We tried to do first in California, to wrap coast in California, but it was impossible to find coast, to get permission, and to jurisdiction and all the bureaucratic complexity to convince people to let us do that temporary work of art. And we have a great luck, a great chance, that sometime by total unpredictable rencontre, we met John Caldor in autumn of 1968. And we turned to John and tell him, John, you are Australian. Australia have the biggest coastline in the world. You probably, we can find the coastline to be wrapped, small section to be wrapped for temporary, like work of art.
How did you find that Australians reacted to this extraordinary work?
At that time, I know only Australia through photograph, films, and books, and have no idea what was Australia. Jean-Claude and myself, we leave actually our little son, who was 9 years old, go to school in Australia for these 2.5-3 months. We're working on the project. But really, everything was so incredible, stimulus, very exciting, and unbelievable. For me, it's like was something unbelievable happened in my life.
Yes. And Christo, what are your memories of the actual project? Was it much more challenging than you imagined? I know that you spoke a lot about the difficulties of the wind.
All our projects, they're much more challenging from the idea to implement it in the reality. Because we never did that, we will never do it again. We have many physical and emotional and human relation and complexity and work in groups and have rock climbers and people in the water securing the anchors and ropes and these big high cliffs and Little Bay. All that, of course, was done not by me, Jean-Claude. We have a great chance that John put together marvelous team, and we work to put together marvelous team from some professional people, the people who fabricated the fabric and the ropes, and also the professional people who was really a professional rock climbers, because much of the high cliffs and the Little Bay was installed by rock climbers, and a great number of young students who will be hired. I remember a number of architectural students who come to work on the project.
Christo, I know it's late in New York and I don't want to keep you up too much, but I did just want to ask you quickly about your next project, which I understand is wrapping the Arc de Triomphe.
Yes, is that. In the last 50 years, Jean-Claude and myself, Jean-Claude is not anymore with us, but always I talk and double because we worked together with Jean-Claude for so long time. Jean-Claude and myself, we realized 23 projects and we do not get permission for 47 projects. Some project was refused, like the Berlin project, like the Gates project, the Paris project, Pont Neuf, and we work hard, and after refusal, finally we get the permission. The permission is the most difficult part of all our projects. And in 1958, we arrived like political refugee from Eastern Europe in Paris, and I see for the first time, not in photograph, a reality, the Arc de Triomphe and the end of Champs-Élysées. In 1962, before we immigrated to the United States, I already proposed something like unbelievable to happen because it was only a dream that probably we never get, but at least I did a photo montage and some sketches of wrapping the Arc of the Triumph in 1962. And I never expected that would happen.
So it has literally taken that long?
Yeah, we have an exhibition of the early works of mine, Jean-Claude, in the Centre Pompidou, Museum National of Modern Art in Paris, and opening in March. And there was a discussion with the director, the chairman, if we can do something outside of the museum. And I was like, impossible dream, I say to the authority that I like to wrap Arc de Triomphe. And this is like miracle, and of course, with enormous circumstance, and the president of France, because it's directly related to French government, we get the permission of less than a year.
What an incredibly exciting project. Christo, thank you so much for taking the time to be here on The Art Show. It's completely thrilling. You are literally one of my favourite artists, so it's an enormous pleasure to speak with you.
Thank you.
Christo, speaking to me from New York, his 1962 idea to wrap the Arc de Triomphe will finally happen next year in Paris. It will be on view for 16 days from the 19th of September, so that's next year. I'm going to start saving. Now, as you heard, he's still very much working in spirit with his wife and collaborator, Jean-Claude, who died in 2009. Well, the Australian public has a very different relationship to contemporary art writ large now, and much of that is thanks to the vision and generosity of one of my next guests, the philanthropist and arts patron, John Caldor. Since Christo and Jean-Claude transformed Little Bay, the Caldor Public Art Projects have seen 34 free, large-scale art pieces for the public. Do you remember Jeff Koons' Flower Puppy on Sydney Harbour, or Gilbert and George's Singing Sculpture? Well, this year is the project's 50th anniversary, and it's being marked with its own major exhibition, created by the British artist Michael Landy, who is joining me this morning with John Caldor, and along with the Australian artist Agatha Goth-Snape, who's also been commissioned to create a new work for these celebrations. John, Michael, Agatha, thank you so much for joining me on the programme from Sydney. I'm sure you're all hard at work preparing for the opening of this big golden celebration.
We certainly are, but it's looking really fantastic. Michael did an incredible job, and he somehow managed to bring 50 years together into one space, one time, and everybody must just come and see it, as it really condenses our history into very approachable ways.
Wonderful. Now, John Caldor, looking at photographs of Rap Coast now, just going back to the beginning of the Caldor Public Art Projects, it's impossible to wonder how it was done, but secondly, really, and perhaps more mainly, why was it done? Why did the Bay get wrapped in 1969? How did you answer that question, perhaps, when people asked you back then?
Well, how many hours have we got?
Not that long, actually. So,
you know, when Christo and Jean-Claude asked me to find them a coastline to rap, and that I took that seriously literally changed my life. You don't ask every day to find a coastline to rap, but they were so charismatic that they convinced me that the most important thing I could do is to find them a coastline to rap.
Oh, fantastic.
And I went along all the foreshores of Sydney, north and south. It was all Army, Navy, or government asking for permissions. Mm. And they just thought I was completely out of my mind to contemplate even something like that, till I came across Prince Henry Hospital, who at that time was a gated hospital, and the administrator thought that if they could charge a small admission, I think it was like 10 cents or something, and we would get the insurance, they would let us do it. Ah. I mean, today it would be just impossible. We didn't have council approval, we didn't have any health or safety, we didn't have any environmental impact studies. We, from start to finish, it was less than a year. You heard Christo say he made a proposal in 1962, which is just taking place now.
Yeah.
So it was just, the stars were aligned, everything worked.
Absolutely.
Perfectly.
I mean, just an iconic art project for the whole of the world, I feel. And John, at what point did you realize, oh, this is something that I need to do more of? Or was that always your intention?
No, not at all. I just wanted Christo to succeed.
Mm.
But once it was finished and successful and had critical acclaim, not only in Australia but internationally, I thought it was just too good to be one off.
Yeah.
So it gave me the courage to do more.
Yes.
And here we are 50 years later.
Absolutely. Michael and Agatha, perhaps you first. Agatha, what's your take on this iconic piece? How much do you see it changing art, particularly public art here in Australia?
Well, I think about the first time I learnt about that work, which was in high school, and to think that as a high school visual arts student, to kind of understand something that actually happened in Australia was quite actually surreal. Mm. to see this. I think back then we really understood, had an idea that of the centre and periphery, that, you know, the main things in art happened elsewhere, and to understand that perhaps that binary was not really how things should be, or what we could imagine something else, I think really changed my understanding of what I could potentially do as an artist. So really a very exciting thing to have in our history, to understand things like that can happen.
Yes.
Here.
And Michael, for you, creating this exhibition that marks the 50 years of the public art projects, Caledore Public Art Projects, how are you including this particular work in your exhibition?
Well, obviously I can't recreate like 100 square foot of material that wraps around Oodle Bay. So each, because John's done 34 projects, and obviously Christo and Jean-Claude's was the first project. So, I mean, as far as that particular project, Project One, then we play it fairly straight as far as, you know, it's more archival material, collages, the original correspondence that between John and Christo, and because that Project One is in a sense how the whole thing begins, and obviously 50 years later we end up with Project 34. So I mean, my job, as I saw it, because John phoned me about a year and a half ago and he asked me, can I create an exhibition about the 50th year? And and that begins with the archive in a sense. So I basically create 34 archive boxes at the New South Wales Art Gallery.
Oh, okay. Oh, I can't wait. So, Michael, you yourself had one of these public art projects back in 2011, your work's Acts of Kindness. So this was about the everyday small gestures of goodwill in our streets that go unnoticed. Can you just explain a little bit how that worked?
I talk about, like, kindness as a thing that people always think kindness, we're all kinder to each other back some in some sort of halcyon days in the 1950s. And I wanted to look up what kindness could mean today. And so it is that kind of connection between self and other. So, you know, and I'm interested in the everyday. And so I was interested in how you kind of can articulate that kind of sense of kindness between complete strangers. And I talk about it as being, you know, it's not just the things we have to offer economically, but we also have our kindness and compassion and what that could mean today. So I basically created a large jigsaw piece in Martin's Place, and I drew out the CBD on the actual jigsaw puzzle, and then each puzzle, there are 200 puzzle pieces,
yeah.
And it sounds a bit confusing, but each story ended up around the CBD. So, you know, it's 200 Sydney-siders gave us 200 stories, and those stories ended up amongst this, you know, in the CBD. So that's Project 24. That's my contribution.
Okay. And Agatha Gough-Snape, you're doing a piece called Lion's Honey for this current anniversary. What does that include, involve?
I think late last year, John and Emily Sullivan, the curator, invited me to begin to think about how I could do a work that maybe accumulated inside the exhibition, so it became a record of the duration of the exhibition at the art gallery. And I went through many iterations of what this work could be. And I think working with John is very relational. So John is definitely in the dialogue with me as I'm thinking of my ideas. And I really enjoy that. In the end, I wanted to reflect upon kind of John's act of benefaction, I guess, and what it is to kind of give these gifts to the public. And so I've devised a kind of durational performative work where I invite seven different readers to sit in within the exhibition, within Michael Landy's exhibition, and read simply to themselves whatever book they choose. So each day of the exhibition, there'll be one reader occupying the space, accumulating knowledge of their choice, reading books that they want to read, content that they want to kind of allow into their bodies quietly to themselves as a kind of very quiet and meditative performance, asking us all, I guess, to think about what we want to draw our attention to, what we want to look away from.
Yeah, thank you, Agatha. John, for you, with all these different artists that you involve in the public art projects, do you personally choose them? Or is it more of a sort of work that you talk about with curators and arts people around the world?
It's a combination of both. Initially, the contemporary art world was very small, and one artist introduced me to another artist that led to another artist, so it was like a chain. Because in the end 60s, early 70s, they all lived within less than a mile of each other in Soho, which at that time they were squatting, as it was a light industrial area, non-residential. I mean, now it's one big shopping mall. But you got to know all of them in the restaurants and became friends, really. And one of the things that I'm really happy with, that artists such as Christo, Gilbert and George, artists that we did projects with 50, 40, 30 years ago, we have still stayed friends. Mm. But to answer your question, we also have a network of international curators and gallery people, and they introduce me to artists and they give me advice.
Okay. And John, for each of you, but starting with you, John, what do you see is the role and the importance of public art? Why wouldn't you just buy a whole bunch of paintings and put them in a private gallery?
Because we're in the 21st century and not in the 18th or 19th.
Good answer.
I think public art, I'm quite evangelical about art. And if you do art in public spaces, you encounter an audience that's very different to the one who's already, made a decision to go to a gallery or to a museum. But we have people of all sorts who see our projects, whether it's at the Botanic Gardens or the Rotunda at
Observatory Hill.
Observatory Hill, or in a church in Redfern. They come upon it unexpectedly, and they look at it, and it's not necessarily art. They're just looking at it, something different that opens their eyes to a new reality.
Mm.
And this is what we aim for,
yeah.
To basically, whether they're young or old, is to widen their vision, to open their eyes to a new reality, to experience something different, and not to frighten people away that art is for the elite and art is, you know, you have to be an intellectual. Art is for everyone, and yeah. we can all learn from art and all experience and all enjoy art. And art today has a very wide definition.
Mm. Michael, for you working on the Kaldor projects, how has it changed your own approach to your practice?
I mean, obviously, I'm a visual artist, so I mean, I create things. And so suddenly, you know, you have like 34 projects spanning 50 years. So it's not my material. So it's not like a malleable material. So everything's kind of has to be filtered through John, and then John speaks to the artist. So it's a very different way of working in that respect.
It has been a wonderful collaboration.
Yeah.
Michael did an outstanding job.
Well, look, it all sounds really exciting, and I'd just like to thank you, John, for putting in so much of your life into these extraordinary public artworks. You know, you really have made the cultural life and beyond, I think, of Australia so much richer. So thank you so much.
Thank you.
And Michael and Agatha as well, thank you so much for coming into the studio, and good luck with your anniversary celebrations.
Thank you very much.
Thanks all for coming onto the show today. So we heard John Kaldor, AO, Director of the Kaldor Public Art Projects, and the artists Michael Landy and Agatha Goth Snape. Michael's exhibition, Making Art Public, 50 Years of Kaldor Public Art Projects, that's on at the Art Gallery of New South Wales until February. Now, there's also a documentary coming up on ABC TV. It's called Doing It in Public, The Kaldor Projects, and it's screening on the 24th of September. That's at 9:30 in the evening, but then I think you'll probably be able to get it on iView as well. And, of course, in the spirit of the projects, all of these things are free.
G'day, person. Josh Sepps here. Now, I know what you're thinking. Josh! You're thinking, old buddy, old pal, where have you been? I haven't heard a new episode of The People Versus, in which you help regular Australians wrestle with the ethics of a big issue in the news, for 147 days. Not that I've been counting, but I have, because it's such a great show. Well, do I have news for you, person. Season 4 of The People Versus with me, Josh Sepps, just started. Catch it up on the ABC Listen app and tune in this Sunday at 4. You're a person, I'm a person, do it.
Next guest is a data journalist. Now, you might be thinking, data journalist? What does that have to do with art? Perhaps you're picturing someone sitting at their desk with a calculator and a ruler, measuring out complicated graphs and boring old pie charts. But trust me when I say this data journalist work will get you thinking about statistics in a whole new way. Her name is Mona Chalabi, and she's the data editor for The Guardian US. Mona takes a colourful approach to data visualisation. Her drawings turn complex data sets into artistic illustrations, and they make all those numbers so much easier to digest. They're provocative, they're enlightening, and sometimes quite funny. Or not. To illustrate the rate of mental illness in children separated from their parents, Mona Chalabi drew a bar graph made of tears. Mona is on Skype from New York now to chat about some work she did recently on the representation of artists in museum collections. Mona, thank you so much for coming onto the Art Show.
Thank you for having me.
So Mona, let's have a bit of a chat about your work in data visualization more broadly. So you visualize data sets. Can you explain for the, you know, so people can visualize this internally, what you actually do?
Yeah, although your description at the top was actually a very good job of it, because a lot of the time I am actually just sat at my desk with a ruler and a calculator, quite tragically, but it's something that I sort of enjoy. So yeah, the way that I kind of see data journalism is to zoom out and give people some context on the things that are happening. So sometimes, like, for example, a news event will happen. An example that comes to mind is some more mass shootings that inevitably happened here a couple of weeks ago in America. And I want to kind of give people some context on the events that are happening and also on the press coverage. So with something like that, kind of the first thing that I do is I start to look at through different data sets. In this case, I was looking for an academic study about how much press coverage different mass shootings get depending on the race of the shooter. And I found a really interesting study. And then I just literally spend ages sitting on my desk visualizing it in different ways. And a really important step when I'm doing that is I often show the visualization to people who have nothing whatsoever to do with data, nothing whatsoever to do with journalism. I'll send it to my mum, I'll show it to a friend. And all of my early drafts on that, actually, I was told made no sense. People really, really couldn't understand what the information was. So, yeah, I just hone and hone and hone and refine it. And then I end up publishing an illustration about the information.
Now, Mona, there's so much of your work around the internet and particularly on the Guardian US website. But I was wondering, just so that we can add to the internal vision of your work, can you describe one of them? So you've done most common dog names in New York, female hirsuteness by race, child separation, US-Mexican border, mass shootings. Can you choose one to describe what they actually look like?
Yeah, sure. So maybe I'll go for the dog one just because it's a little bit more upbeat and a lot of the subjects that I can cover a little bit grim. So with that one, I found a data set on the most, it wasn't even the most common dog names in New York. It was just about all of the dog names in New York. And so I filtered the data set and I found like the most common ones. And the illustration itself is a row of dogs with their bums in the air and their tails up high. And the length of the tail shows you how popular that dog name is. And if I remember rightly, I think the most common dog name is Bella. And it was a really funny example, actually, of kind of data journalism reaching a community that I didn't really expect it to. So when I was drawing it, I thought, oh God, this is really, really boring. It's just going to be of interest to dog owners and more specifically dog owners in New York. But actually the illustration did really well because so many people tagged friends, cousins, people with the name Bella to be like, ha ha ha, you have a dog's name. And as a result, the illustration kind of was spread far and wide, which really surprised me.
Yes, it's great. Now, Mona, you've got the most amazing qualifications internationally. Masters in international security from Paris.
Yeah.
Is that right? So how did drawing come into your work?
That's a really good question. Yeah, so after I graduated, I went to go and work for an NGO. I was working for the International Organization for Migration, which is now part of the UN. And we were trying to find out how many Iraqis had been displaced from their homes as a result of the war, how many had been forced to other countries, how many were returning back. And basically, I just really became a little bit disillusioned with those kinds of reports because we were actually publishing really, really important information, but no one was seeing it and no one cared. And what's interesting now is actually I get approached by so many NGOs and charities that are saying to me, please help us to make other people care about this information. So, the next natural step for me from there was basically to try and get into journalism. But I think I went into data journalism and I quite quickly became frustrated with the computer generated charts because I think they kind of convey this false neutrality and this precision in the data, which actually isn't true. Humans are responsible for making decisions all the time about which data to show you and how to present it to you. And I wanted to be really, really honest about that. But also the other problem with those computer generated charts, sorry for going on a bit of a rant here.
But, no, rant away.
Is that if you take away the labels, they could be about any subject whatsoever. And so as a result, they're kind of hard to remember, right? Like I've seen a bar chart on murder rates in different communities, and I've also seen a bar chart on like the most popular sandwich types or whatever.
Yeah.
And like the way that they lodge into my mind is kind of like the same mental bucket or something. And that shouldn't be the case, right? How I feel about a chart about sandwiches shouldn't be just the emotions that elicits when you see charts that demonstrate issues of social justice.
Yeah.
And I think it's okay to create charts that are intended to elicit an emotional response. And I'm kind of unapologetic about that, I guess.
Mona, here on the art show here in Australia, I interview artists of all types. And some, for me, certainly some of the most exciting artists are the conceptual artists. And one might say that your work is in its own way conceptual art. So do you consider yourself an artist?
It still feels a little bit uncomfortable to me, partly because I think it's such an amazing title to have.
Yes.
So it feels a bit like, it feels a bit big-headed almost to describe myself that way. But I recently did an exhibition, and as part of the exhibition, I put up like a lot of my work in one of the rooms, and the work actually didn't fit into one of the rooms. I thought it would. And I've created over, in that exhibition alone, there were over 400 pieces up, and that wasn't all of my work. And I was like, okay, to see it all in one place, I thought, okay, maybe I can call myself this. It's a visual language, and that is what art is, right? It's
just
a visual
absolutely.
Language.
Yes.
Yeah.
Mona, let's talk about that exhibition. So you recently crunched the numbers on the representation of men, women, and people of colour in art museums. So first of all, what did you find, and then how did you illustrate that?
Yes, so I came across this study that was published by a guy called Chad Topaz, who's a professor of mathematics. And him and his colleagues looked at 18 major art museums in the US, and they looked at all of their collections, so thousands and thousands of pieces of work. And then they contrasted that with the US population. And when they looked at all of those collections, what they found was that just 12% of the artists in major US art museums are women. So 88% of them are men, and 75% of all of the artists are white men specifically. And just to, you know, that's, I mean, the point of contrasting it with the US population is also just to see that this isn't a question of a lack of diversity. It's a problem of a lack of representation. So those art museums in no way reflect the US population. And so is it any wonder that many of the people who go to those art museums also don't reflect the US population?
Yes, absolutely. And that's sadly the case across all of the arts. So how did you then illustrate these findings?
Yeah, so I did a bit of research into like the kind of architecture of different museum spaces, and I created a background that was kind of in line with a lot of the architecture that I'd seen in those spaces. And then in the foreground, there are 100 figures, and those 100 figures represent 100% of the people that are exhibited in major US museum collections. So as I said, 12 of those figures in the foreground are women, 11 of them are white women, and just one is an Asian woman. And then 88 of those figures in the foreground are men, 75 of them are white men, 8 are Asian, 3 are Latinx, and 1 is black. And then there's one man of another race or ethnicity. And then in the background, I've added in over 200 figures. And those are all of the people that would need to be added to the painting for the overall picture to actually represent the US population. Mm. And so what you see is that in the background, there are loads and loads of women and people of colour in the background of that painting.
Yeah. Okay, so then the next step was that you held an exhibition of this work in London, and then you documented that experience on Instagram, which is so great. I urge people to follow you on Instagram.
Thank you.
It's absolutely fascinating. The discoveries that you made, I mean, first of all, just the different steps of actually launching an exhibition, and then your own data analysis of it. Can you just give a kind of brief summary of that?
Yeah, so I'm really obsessed with spreadsheets, which I suppose is no surprise. So along the whole process of doing the exhibition, I was meticulously keeping accounts of everything. And one of the things that really, really shocked me was just the sheer cost of it. So the exhibition altogether ended up costing me almost £6,000, which for any artist is just a huge, I mean, for anyone, but particularly if you're not incredibly wealthy, is a huge outlay. And understanding the way that the gallery system works and that they take 50% of the sales and that that's how they run, I don't know, it just came as such a shock to me. And I think I was a little bit disenchanted with that, to be honest. I don't think I will put on another exhibition in a private gallery again. And I felt it was really important to share that, and I got so many messages from art students saying, wow, I didn't realize it would be that expensive, and this makes me rethink how I want to go about this, which is sad.
Yes.
But it's also important to go to if I had known at the outset that it was going to cost me that much, I wouldn't have done it. And it's difficult because I want to price my work in a way that is just as accessible as the journalism is, right?
Yeah.
But actually, there's no way I can price it reasonably and recoup that expenditure.
Let's say a 10-year-old girl at the moment, a 10-year-old girl with, let's say, an African-American heritage, she wants to go into art. From the data that you've seen right now, what are her chances of succeeding?
Yeah, it's a really good question. Again, I wish I had data on social class because I think that plays a huge role. Yeah. But even if you take that out of the equation, I would say her chances aren't great. And it's difficult because I actually think this is kind of the flip side of data, right? Is there a problem in me articulating that fact that would actually make that young girl just feel pessimistic and think, I don't have a chance, I'm not going to go for it. And in that way, data can actually become a self-fulfilling prophecy, right? Because you're constantly told you don't have a shot at this. And so, yeah, it's hard. I want to create pressure on policymakers and the people who run these institutions to understand that that's a problem. But I also don't want to discourage that young girl. Yeah. But the truth is, yeah, she would have to work harder, work longer, and be better to be able to succeed. And that's just the reality of it.
Yeah. Well, Mona, thank you for illustrating reality, because I guess that's kind of what you do, actually, isn't it?
Oh, thank you. I try.
I'm thrilled by your work. Wendy Love, the producer here, introduced me to your work, and it's just been a delight to speak with you. Thank you.
You too. Thank you so, so much. And if ever anyone has any ideas, again, I'm really, really open to suggestions. So if anyone has any data they'd like to have visualized about any part of their lives or society, I'm very open to suggestions. So thank you.
Great. Thanks so much, Mona. And we'll put all your information up on our website.
Thank you. Have a lovely day. I really appreciate you taking the time to chat.
Thanks so much, Mona. Mona Chalabi, journalist, writer, film producer, and she's the data editor at The Guardian US. Come on over to our website for more on Mona and to see some of her incredibly informative illustrations. You're listening to The Art Show here on RN, and hello now to Alice Walker for Arts News. So Alice, it's been 1 year since Brazil's National Museum in Rio de Janeiro burnt down. So what's the latest?
Monday marked 1 year since a fire caused by a faulty air conditioner destroyed the museum. It housed around 20 million objects, and it was initially thought that 90% of them had been destroyed. Happily, that's not the case, Ed. It turns out it was 46%, but losing almost half of your collection is obviously still a massive loss.
Yeah, that must have been so devastating for the staff and students who'd spent all those years working there. Yeah.
It's been so upsetting that many of them are getting tattoos of the museum. There's even a hashtag that translates to museum on my skin. But the museum has finally announced plans to reopen. It wants to restore part of the building by 2022 in time for the bicentennial celebrations of Brazilian independence. Reconstruction is set to begin on the museum's facade as well, though it sounds like there's still a fair bit of money to find as the total cost of the restoration hasn't been finalised.
Okay, now moving on. Now, Alice, it's sometimes hard to think about at the ABC, but what's your 5-year plan?
That's a story that's still unfolding, Ed, but I can tell you about a couple of other 5-year plans. For starters, the Australia Council has just released its 5-year corporate plan. It shows the council beat all its KPIs from 2018 to 19 by anywhere from 110 to 243%, and it sets new targets for attendances and for how many public works come out of it. But it's not forecasting much increase in budget over the next 5 years or any change in staffing levels, which is probably not surprising, but will no doubt be disappointing to the arts organisations who are calling for funding to be restored to the Australia Council after the much talked about cuts 5 years ago.
All right, so there's no showers of gold in this report.
Not
no surprises.
This time.
No. So what does it say?
So it, as well as setting the targets for attendance and for public works, it also says that the Australia Council is going to gather data on diversity for audiences and also for artists and people who get grants. And now let me tell you about the South Australian government's plan. This is the first arts plan for the state in almost 20 years, and it's just been released. It comes off the back of an external review that didn't advocate, quote, significant additional government expenditure, but it did say there was an urgent need to address storage for the state's collections and to accelerate and coordinate digitisation of those collections as well. And it also spoke of a siloed culture and need for more collaboration, including with other government sectors like education, health, employment, regional development, and tourism as well.
So does the government plan call for collaboration?
It does. So the Marshall Liberal Government's Art and Culture Plan for 2019 to 2024 outlines strategic collaboration as one of its four key values. Arts Industry Council of South Australia Chair Gail Kovachev says it's a call for entrepreneurialism as a way of pushing the sector away from reliance on government funding.
Obviously, that collaborations and partnerships and formulating new ways of doing things is as always advantageous, but I definitely think that one of the drivers behind that being such a focus is the fact that there's a sense that there will be no new funding, which, you know, no one denies that the South Australian government is doing it hard, that there is a lack of resources, the tax base is shrinking and all of those, whilst it's the oldest population in the nation, population isn't growing. So it's very difficult to produce an extremely forward-looking strategy within that context. And so they're looking at questions of how to do what is being done better, and I think they are looking for using collaborations or partnerships as one sort of idea about how that might come about.
Gail Kovachev there. She says it's great to have an arts plan and there's a lot of good work and consultation behind it and there's some valuable goals in it. But after recent state cuts, she says there aren't many initiatives to show how to get there.
Okay, so you can find a link to both the Australia Council and the South Australian government's plans on our website. But staying in South Australia, Alice, tell me about the Kennedy Prize.
This is a $25,000 prize awarded to works that embody, comment on, or celebrate beauty. This year's winner is Victorian artist Jack Grantford for her portrait of Melbourne drag queen Tootsie. Ken Tootsie Atherton passed away at the age of 84, just a couple of weeks after the painting was completed last year. He was in prison for 2 years for his homosexuality when he was 20, but eventually would become affectionately known as the oldest drag queen in the Southern Hemisphere. Jack Grantford says that made her win all the more special.
Oh, I felt so passionate about it because Tootsie was reviled in his youth for being who he was and now he's being celebrated for being beautiful. I mean, it's just so wonderful.
You can see all 50 finalists at the Kennedy Prize exhibition at the South Australian State Library until the 15th of September.
Great. Thanks so much to Alice Walker. Alice there with Arts News.
You're listening to The Art Show with Ed Ayres.
Jewellery is an art form we're quite keen on here at The Art Show, but I don't think we've ever had a guest whose jewellery is as politically charged as Susan Conn's. Susan is a contemporary designer who makes jewellery that is wearable, but also jewellery that comments on the moral dilemmas and questions she sees facing our world. So this includes a necklace that can survive a bomb blast and a USB necklace that holds precious information for newly arrived migrants. Now, 3 years ago, during the height of Europe's migrant crisis, she heard of a story from Denmark that pushed her to do something more. Her performance slash talk, Meaninglessness, is about jewellery and other objects that carry real meaning in our lives. She's now appearing at Radiant Pavilion. That's the Contemporary Jewellery Biennial in Melbourne. Susan, welcome to The Art Show.
Hello, Ed. Thank you.
So, Susan, what actually happened in Denmark in 2016?
The government passed a legislation which decreed that any assets over $2,000 Australian, including meaningless jewellery, would be confiscated by the Danish border authorities to subsidise the upkeep of people seeking asylum in Denmark.
Okay, now, so these laws were not passed, but then
they
what
were.
Happened?
They became
they
law.
They were it
became,
actually
it's
passed.
Still, it's still the. It's called the jewellery legislation, and it's still in place.
Okay, so how did this affect you and the way that you think about jewellery?
Well, because I'm a jeweller, it affected me deeply. You know, there's no such thing as meaningless jewellery. It always has some sort of meaning for the wearer, whether that's historical or personal. And for people fleeing war, of course, war and trauma, jewellery is currency for them. So to take away any jewellery is to take away someone's identity and their independence.
Yes. Was there ever an actual kind of definition given of what you would class as meaningless jewellery?
Well, the discussion when the law was proposed, there was outcry and the government said that people could keep their wedding rings. And then there was a further outcry, and this politician, this is where the title comes from, said, okay, people can keep their engagement rings, but we will take any meaningless jewellery, which is just a horrible statement, because, as I said, there's no such thing.
Yes, I mean, it does seem to be quite random. So, as you say, you know, the value of jewellery can be fickle. The cheapest necklace, it can hold great sentimental importance. Precious heirlooms can be traded as legal tender. But what about your own relationship to jewellery?
Jewellery to me is a language. I'm fascinated with how jewellery talks for people. How it represents our culture, it represents our times, it shows our social habits. This is a deep curiosity that will follow me to my grave, I think.
Yeah. Susan, can you think of an item of jewellery, either your own or somebody else's, that really illustrates your point of just how important it can be?
Yes, in my performance, I talk about a medal that was awarded to my great-grandfather for his services to the Jewish community in China. And his name was Solomon Kahn, and on the medal there's the inscription has been shortened to S. Kahn, and that's why it was given to me. Mm. And I have a photograph of him wearing it when he was awarded it, and the medal represents my whole family migration story in China and from China to Australia. Mm. So, yes, that has no financial value, but it's rich in meaning.
So with your own now, I mean, you have the medal, and with your own creations, can you tell me more about this necklace that can survive a bomb blast?
That was a work that bubbled up as such when I was watching an interview on the ABC after the Bali bombings, and it was of some parents who were lamenting that they had nothing left of their daughter. And I started to think about whether you could make jewellery that carried a message and survived a bomb blast. And it just seemed sort of almost out of world proposition, but I started to explore it and was able to find a solution through working with a range of people, a mathematician, a forensic scientist. I was able to experiment with blowing it up and seeing what happened to it. And it's a very simple piece of jewellery that's a stainless steel shell with two titanium message tags embedded in a ceramic blanket, which is the same material that's on the outside of the NASA space shuttle. And so when it blows up, the ceramic material absorbs the blast and the two metal tags stay intact.
Okay.
So it's to allow someone, an unsuspecting bomb victim, to send a message back to a loved one.
Wow, an extraordinary creation. And how about the USB necklace that holds precious information for newly arrived migrants?
Well, horrified with Australians' approach to asylum seekers. I started to think, how could I, as a ordinary citizen or simple jeweller, make a gesture towards someone who had gone through such a journey and arrived in this country. And they don't need jewellery, they need clothes, they need a home, they need a job. Jewellery could be seen to be the last thing that they might need. So I was trying to think of a welcome gift of some sort. And it occurred to me that whenever you arrive in anywhere, to a new place, that you need to know the information about the area, you know, so that the transport, the rubbish days, what the hours of banks are, whatever, even the football teams.
Mm.
So I thought I should make a piece of jewellery that carried all that information, and that would be a very valuable gift to a newcomer.
Yes, absolutely. Now, Susan, I would say that in your own role as jeweler and now performance artist, that's fairly rare. Do you know other jewelers who work in a political sphere as well?
There's a small group of like-minded jewelers, but it's not a common approach to jewellery, and I wouldn't call myself a performance artist by any means. This is a performance talk, and it's just trying to have a conversation about jewellery. It's not performance art as such. And having conversations and talking about ideas and effects of the cultural things that are happening, I think is quite not so unusual. It's just this work required the conversation.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, thank you for coming onto the show, and thank you for the work that you've been doing and continue to do. Thank you. Susan Conn, a contemporary jeweller whose work is held at galleries and museums here and overseas. Susan will be presenting a talk about her performance. It's called Meaninglessness, and that's part of Radiant Pavilion, the Contemporary Jewellery and Object Biennial in Melbourne. Well, last week on the show, I was speaking with genius and general dude, the art critic Sebastian Smee, and Sebastian was talking about his emotional response to visiting Matisse's chapel and how he wanted to cry, but he didn't want to upset his kids. You remember, it was just the most amazing interview last week from him. And anyway, you responded with your own stories about how art has, in Sebastian's words, made you undone. Paula Scully wrote that she was in Melbourne visiting the National Gallery, and the gallery was holding a retrospective of works by Edvard Munch. And Paula writes, as soon as I looked at the first painting, I felt like, yes, like I was being undone. It was a landscape. And like your guest today, I did cry and would have thrown myself on the floor of the gallery and sobbed had it not been for the security guards hovering. And Jeffrey Skews left this message.
The work that most moved me, most because it has returned in memory many times. And really, I cried. It was the more than 7-metre masterpiece painting, Spirit Dreaming Through Nappabee, 1980 by Tim Lehrer and Clifford Possum, Jappaljari, at the NGV in Melbourne. I think the intense emotional response to this artwork is bound up in several key ways. The scale, the colours, design, motifs and evident consummate skill is quite overwhelming. However, the history and cultural significance of this masterpiece truly resonate the profound position and role that Indigenous art plays in our culture. I guess I just love it because it does bring me to tears.
Jeffrey Skews. And finally, Zoe Wheat's response. This was to an installation presented by John Caldor at Carriage Works, titled 13 Rooms.
I walked into this tiny room, quite an enclosed space, one of Marina Abramovich's amazing installations. And there was a naked woman up on the wall, just as you walked in, full on naked, legs apart, arms apart, suspended almost, but as if she was on a cross, I suppose. But high up, out of reach, totally vulnerable, with all these people looking at her, and she was totally defenseless. And I just burst into very heavy sobbing and had to leave. And I'm still quite disturbed by it. And I think it reached amazing emotional areas of my own vulnerability, fear, defenseless. Every woman, and maybe some men, would have responded in some way.
Thanks so much, Zoe Wheaton. Well, that's it for the Art Show for today. Thank you so much for all your messages. And just a reminder to continue that theme of emotional release with art. Would you pass a hanky to someone if you saw them weeping in a gallery? Or would you just leave them alone? Let me know. artsonrn@abc.net.au. That's artsonrn@abc.net.au. Well, I hope that you have a happy and maybe sometimes weepy week. Oh, actually, said out loud, that does sound a little bit weird. Anyway, the programme was made with love and virtually no tears by Wendy Love, Rosa Ellen, Dave White. My name's Ed Ayres. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.